Welcome to another episode of the Left of Lansing podcast with Pat Johnston. A progressive insight into Michigan's political and cultural world. And of course, an entertaining podcast designed to shine a light on how to make Michigan's political machine work for the people. Now, from the Left of Lansing headquarters, located in his attic, here's the award-winning Pat Johnston.
Oh, yeah! Welcome to another installment of Michigan's premier progressive podcast. I am Pat Johnston, who is somewhat happy that Consumers Energy is starting to put some power lines underground for a change. Yay! Consumers is beginning a pilot program where it's putting about 10 miles of power lines underground in six different counties. Now, Consumers customers, which includes me, will pay an extra $1.50 a month for this program, which got me thinking, wait a minute. Consumers Energy and DTE already have so much money that they're handing out to politicians in Lansing. Why did the Michigan Public Service Commission grant this rate hike to begin with? Doesn't make sense. Seems like Consumers could do it on their own. So once again, the people are paying higher energy costs for something which should have been done a long time ago, and it would have saved us money. Planet Detroit just wrote a story saying a recent report highlighted Michigan's long-term reliability problems, finding it was the second worst state for power outages between 2000 and 2021. Another report found that Michigan was the fourth worst state for restoration time following an outage in 2021, with DTE taking the longest to restore power among Michigan's investor-owned utilities. In 2022, DTE and Consumers Energy showed modest improvement in reliability compared to 2021, but the average customer was without power for roughly 10 hours and 8 hours, respectively. This is well above the national average of 5.5 hours. Our good friends at the Michigan Environmental Justice Coalition just wrote, DTE Energy's influence over the Michigan legislature and the Michigan Public Service Commission is preventing meaningful reform. We need representatives and regulators that act on behalf of the people, not wealthy corporations. This means taking DTE money out of Lansing. Yes, but that can only happen if we demand it. Same with a new polluter pay bill, which I talked about last week with Clean Water Action Michigan's Sean McBrady, and you could check that episode out in case you missed it last week. Now, this is something that I think that a majority of you really want because the majority of you voted for it in the weekly LOL poll in which I asked if you wanted Michigan Democrats to pass the polluter pay bill this year, making corporations accountable for cleaning up the land, air, and water that they contaminate. 87% of you said yes, while 13% of you said, no, I'd really like to pay for the mess that corporations leave. Yeah, I'd rather do it. Really, really, really smart there, guys. I'll announce my new poll for the week after my interview with Dr. Sarah Mosliner, who's done some fantastic research into the white Christian nationalist movement, which is a subject I've talked about a lot here. Dr. Mosliner from Central Michigan University will join me here in just a few moments. You know, we had the Michigan primary last week, which I covered, and just like this week's Super Tuesday, the Republican Party is Trump's party. So we're going to go through this whole thing again. But back here in our state, it didn't matter if crazy Christo-fascist Christina Cuomo or pathetic Pete Hoekstra were leading the state party, since all Michigan Republicans can agree on one thing, that Donald Trump is their dear leader. Trump defeated challenger Nikki Haley in last week's primary, then secured all 39 delegates in the state's GOP congressional caucuses. That means he ends up winning 51 of the state's 55 delegates at the Republican National Convention. And it happened even though the state GOP was in the midst of an internal battle between factions fighting on who could out-MAGA the other. But in the end, the Pete Hoekstra wing won in court, ruling that former Chair Cuomo was indeed replaced fair and square. So the former congressman and Trump ambassador to the Netherlands is back in power, promising to bring the party's finances back in order after Cuomo and her people basically emptied the whole bank account. But make no mistake, on the ideological scale, there's no daylight between Karamo and Hoekstra. Sure, unlike Karamo, Pete Hoekstra may not believe in demonic possession. At least, he hasn't publicly announced that he does. I don't know, maybe he does. But don't think for a second that Hoekstra represents some mythical, normal Republican. I've always said that Trump didn't happen in a vacuum. The mean-spiritedness, the racism, the misogyny, the pro-corporate, anti-worker beliefs, and the belief that they are always on the right side have always been hallmarks of the Republican Party for my entire lifetime. Trump just learned how to say the quiet parts out loud, and he knew he'd be rewarded by both the corporatists and the religious extremists in his party. And that's why Hoekstra staunchly defended Trump way back in 2016. You remember? He served as one of the five co-chairs for Trump's campaign here in the state. I mean, he loved Trump's style of always being on the attack, never apologizing, being aggressive, siding with management, and most of all, owning the libs. Trump rewarded Hoekstra for his loyalism by appointing him the ambassador to the Netherlands. Since Hoekstra was born there and then immigrated to the United States when he was a boy, of course, Hoekstra didn't believe in the great replacement theory then, I guess not. Now, you would think being an ambassador to the Netherlands would be nice, would be a nice, comfy little job for Pete. I mean, what happens in that kind of job? I wouldn't think much, right? Well, no. During his first year, Hoekstra was questioned by a Dutch reporter over Hoekstra's Islamophobic remarks that he made in 2015, in which he claimed that the Netherlands had enacted no-go zones since Dutch politicians and vehicles were being set on fire by radical Islam. Now, at first, Hoekstra stood his ground like a tough little Trumper and said that he never made such remarks. In fact, he even used Trump's fake news phrase. But the reporter brought receipts and the video clip of Hoekstra indeed making such remarks during that panel, which was titled Muslim Migration into Europe, Arabia Come True? Here, listen to those remarks by Pete Hoekstra.
The Islamic movement has now gotten to a point where they have put Europe into chaos. Chaos in the Netherlands, there are cars being burned, there are politicians that are being burned.
Now, after showing the video, the reporter asked Pete Hoekstra if it's still fake news. And pathetic Pete then tried to say he didn't say the words fake news, which was laughable considering that's what he just said. And due to the fact, though, that the video caught Hoekstra in a lie, he did have to later apologize, which isn't really Trumpian, but he had no choice. He got caught. Still, that little incident illustrated how Hoekstra was trying to use the Trump playbook. That playbook is described by Dick Pullman in a 2017 column on WHYY, and I quote, "This little incident shows us the Trump brand in action, the knee-jerk impulse to slime free and independent journalism, not just at home, but in Western nations that have long sought to model America's freedom. We freed the Dutch from Nazism so that it could practice those freedoms, including a free press. To insult the Dutch with such lies is a betrayal of American values and another black mark on our worsening image abroad. But that's the standard practice for the occupying forces in Washington." Again, that was back in 2017 when Trump was in the White House. So let this be a reminder of how Pete Hoekstra also believes in and uses the right-wing Islamophobia playbook. He was so comfortable telling outright lies about Dutch no-go zones because he felt comfortable talking that way, being that racist inside his little circle of white Christian nationalist friends. But like others from that side, Pathetic Pete just found ways to tiptoe between the raindrops. Hoekstra returned home to run for Michigan's governor's race, which he lost to Rick Snyder, who would then lead Michigan to economic and environmental ruin. But Hoekstra didn't stop there. He ran against Democratic U.S. Senator Debbie Stabenow in 2012 and promptly got blown out, partly because of this racist ad that he ran during the Super Bowl of that year, featuring an Asian-American actress speaking in broken English, thanking Stabenow for spending money in Washington, which somehow weakened America while strengthening China. Here was the ad.
"Thank you, Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow. Debbie spends so much American money. You borrow more and more from us. Your economy gets very weak. Ours get very good. We take your jobs. Thank you, Debbie Spend It Now."
"I think this race for U.S. Senate is between Debbie Spend It Now and Pete Spend It Not. I'm Pete Spend It Not Hoekstra, and I approve this message.
Everyone, that was 2012. It wasn't that long ago. And the racism is right there in your face. It's the same anti-Asian racism that we're seeing today from the MAGA crowd and their quest to stop EV battery plants from being constructed in Michigan, like the proposed Goshen plant around Big Rapids. In fact, former Michigan Republican Congressman and current U.S. Senate candidate Mike Rogers posted the following on X. He said, "Michigan deserves a leader who will stand up for our interests, not one who will advocate for communist China's." See, the anti-Asian rhetoric is alive and well in Rogers' campaign, too, and he's supposedly the moderate. Former GOP strategist Jeff Timmer, who is a co-host of A Republic, If You Can Keep It podcast, responded to Mike Rogers with the following on Twitter, and I quote, "Michigan U.S. Senate candidate Mike Rogers apparently calling for the ouster of the new Michigan GOP chair and his former congressional colleague Pete Hoekstra, who lobbied for a CCP-tied company sanctioned by the U.S. government." Now, that is a perfect response there. And Timmer does a great job of exposing the hypocrisy of Republicans. So I looked up this old Detroit news story by reporter Craig Mauger, who found that, yes, Pete Hoekstra did some lobbying work for a Chinese-based company. Now, don't forget, and I might forget, which is why I'm reminding myself and you about this little known fact, is that Hoekstra joined in the effort to block the Goshen EV plant from being constructed in Mecosta County. But I bet he thought many would forget his lobbying days. Well, Craig Mauger did some excellent reporting. This is what he said in that story. The former Republican congressman and U.S. ambassador to the Netherlands also has been listed as a member of the board of directors for the Mecosta County Environmental Security Alliance, which was formed to fight the Goshen factory. "This is the mentality of China," Hoekstra said during an April 18th press conference. "Businesses are there to serve the interest of the government. The interest of the government is the Chinese Communist Party and their agenda." But Hoekstra has been less outspoken about his past work for Zhejiang Dehua TB Import and Export Company, which has been described as the largest and first public stock plywood and wood veneers manufacturer in China. The Washington, D.C.-based law firm Dick Stein Shapiro, which sounds more porn than anything, listed Hoekstra as the lobbyist for Zhejiang Dehua TB Import and Export Company on a 2013 filing with the U.S. House. So it appears Hoekstra was pro-Chinese companies doing business here in America before he was against it. Hoekstra claims the situations, though, are different, which I'm sure they are, Pete. I'm sure they are. And let's be real, they want to block the site, a site in which Governor Whitmer can use for job creation numbers. That's why they want to block it. That's why Hoekstra and Michigan MAGA are against it. Hoekstra's always been Trumpian way before Trump. He's always been MAGA way before MAGA. He believes in this Christian nationalism that pervades the entire Republican Party, both nationally and here in the state of Michigan. He believes he is always right. He is always fighting for management. He will use racism whenever he needs some kind of argument to scare up the people and to stir people up. I mean, don't forget, Hoekstra started the Tea Party Caucus, which is the precursor to MAGA. He's always fought against abortion rights, LGBTQ+ rights, and paid parental leave rights for federal workers. While doing all that, he fought for the gun lobby. Progress Michigan also reminds us that he voted against the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, in which he considered fair wages for women to be a nuisance. And don't minimize Hoekstra's votes to grant big oil and gas companies lavish tax breaks as he fights to stop EV plants in this state. Don't underestimate that. Yes, crazy Christine Okramo may be gone, but pathetic Pete Hoekstra's history of MAGA extremism is there for all of us to see. The Michigan Republican Party is the same as it ever was. White Christian nationalism is preparing to use Trump to get into the White House, and it's hoping to turn Michigan State House from blue to right wing this November as well. This movement is happening, and it's up to us to fight against it to save democracy and to save the country. It's up to us to stop them from gaining power nationally and also within our state government. Dr. Sarah Mosliner has spent years researching, writing, lecturing, and sharing the history of the white Christian nationalist movement. She's joining me here in a moment to discuss its origin in the white culture myth that's rooted in our nation's history and how its main goal is to have dominion over everybody and everything. Whew, you're listening to LOL.
A podcast devoted to intelligence, sanity, and freedom, or otherwise known as progressive politics. It's Left of Lansing with your host, Pat Johnston. Need to tell Pat where he's wrong? Or do you actually want to praise Pat? Leftoflansing@gmail.com is how to reach him. Here's Pat.
That's right. If you'd like to read more about what I said about Pete Hoekstra in my opening there, including the video of that anti-Muslim conference that he attended a few years ago, just visit leftoflansing.com and you'll find my post about Hoekstra's extremism or white Christian nationalism extremism right there. And let me say a quick thanks to my good friend Rich, who brought leftoflansing.com back to life so that way you can read my weekly musings and get an archive of all of my episodes. And that includes my Friday Left of Lansing shorts. That's all on leftoflansing.com. All right. Well, again, as you heard before the break, I was talking about how people like Pete Hoekstra are part of the Christian nationalist movement, or the white Christian nationalist movement, a movement which has taken over the Republican Party after years and years of hard work. And I wanted to bring someone on who has more knowledge and more expertise into the white Christian nationalist movement here on the show. And that's why I'm thrilled to have such an expert on here this week. Dr. Sarah Mosliner is a lecturer in the Department of Philosophy, Anthropology, and Religion at Central Michigan University. Go Fire Up Chips. She's also a writer and researcher and authored the book titled Virgin Nation, Sexual Purity, and American Adolescence. And Dr. Mosliner also just wrapped up an 8-part podcast series called Pure White, which you can find just about anywhere you listen to your podcast. So after you're done listening to our discussion here, check out Dr. Mosliner's podcast. You will not regret it, I promise you. Dr. Sarah Mosliner, thanks so much for being on Left of Lansing this week. I appreciate it.
You're very, very welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
Let's talk a little shop here, if you don't mind, since you hosted your own podcast. I know that you've been a guest on several other podcasts, but it's a bit different when the spotlight is on you and you are the host. So what is Pure White all about? And what did you find to be the most rewarding? And tell us maybe the most challenging about doing your own podcast.
Sure. Yeah. So it's a limited series. It's an 8-part docu-series about a topic I've been studying for 15 years, sexual purity, and looking at it as historically connected to white supremacy, specifically in the United States. And so I am a professional history nerd. And so I like to take people with me in deep into my nerd holes. So that is what this is. You know, I'd never written a podcast episode before, which is different than writing a book chapter, writing a lecture for class. And so I think that was the most challenging in terms of, you know, saying all the things I really felt that needed to be said in a short, compact amount of time without it being too much. And I do think they are too much because the topics lend themselves to that. And I really didn't know what I was getting into, but fortunately, working with Straight White American Jesus and Access Mundi Media, they were able to sort of pick up the parts that I didn't know how to do, so the technical pieces of it. So I got to just sort of sit with the ideas. So writing the episodes was really the most challenging, and thinking about what other voices do we need to bring into this conversation, because I didn't want it to just be me talking, but to actually bring in experts. And so trying to, I think that, you know, the hardest part is everything that ends up on the cutting room floor. So what I'd really love to do is to be able to release the interviews that I did sort of uncut, because there's so much that didn't make it into the series. I think the best part for me, so I have been, you know, a trained academic, I teach college, I publish for a few years now, been wanting to do more public-facing work, which means thinking about your audience very differently, not as other academics, but as just people looking for an interesting podcast. Right. And so this was really a great opportunity to think about the voice I use when I write, to think about my audience differently, and try and sort of, you know, make something that is accessible and engaging and be less concerned with my own intellectual gravitas, you know, which gets old really, really fast in this career.
Well, listen, you really did a remarkable job. It's very engaging, not boring at all. So everybody, please check that out. You know, Doctor, I've read in your bio that you were once part of the, I guess you'd say, the evangelical movement, mm-hmm. or the church when you were younger. Was that because of family, or did you become a fierce believer in what the church was advocating, or was it a bit of both?
Yes, so it was by birthright. I was born into a Christian family. I was a preacher's kid. I went to Christian school K through 12, went to a Christian college, one you've probably heard of here in Michigan. So yeah, so my early life was very much about living in that world. And I very much internalized all the rules of that world and wanted to really be the best. And the particular evangelical world I grew up in was very fond of giving awards to people for being, you know, the best Christian. You know, before the age of 18, I won a couple of those awards and I was incredibly proud. I knew how to achieve in this context in particular. It was like my wheelhouse. And now, of course, that has just left me with all sorts of questions and weird feelings about every kind of award out there, because it's just a strange thing to sort of be given. Basically, I was being rewarded for being obedient, for internalizing all of these things about Christianity, about the United States, and especially because I would say I very much grew up in the pro-life movement. And so about, you know, what was good for the United States, what was good for me. And so as long as I conformed to that and sort of rose to and used my voice in favor of all of those things, you know, I was rewarded for that behavior. So as you can imagine, that's given me a lot to chew on later in life.
I bet. Well, and you wrote how college, or at least your time in college, changed your whole viewpoint or perspective on mm-hmm. life. And I'm wondering if there was something specific, like was there just this moment where your eyes opened up to this whole new perspective on life, or a perspective mm-hmm. that was foreign to you? Or was it something that you read? Mm-hmm. Was it something that you heard someone say? Or was it like an amalgamation of events that allowed you to question your mm-hmm. whole life philosophy up to that point?
Yeah, it's interesting. I do have specific events, but they've all... So yes, I mean, all of that.
Okay.
I would say the first thing that actually I think one of the best decisions I made was to study theater in college. And so though I went to a Christian college in West Michigan, since I studied theater, I spent lots of time with people in the arts and people sort of in the seedy underbelly of West Michigan, which is just like anyone else's neighborhood, but in Michigan, like, you know, so I sort of learn to appreciate and be drawn toward creativity. And I had always sort of sought expressions of creativity, which I didn't really have a lot of access to. And so studying theater was for me a perfect marriage between sort of my needs for intellectual engagement, but also a need for creativity. And there was sort of a fluidity of thought there that I felt very comfortable. So I was in a place where I could begin to ask questions. And especially for me, so this is the early 90s, becoming aware of openly gay people was kind of my, you know, a new threshold for me. Mm-hmm. And we had on campus a very kind of vile homophobic speaker. It was electric. Like, I had never experienced anything like that. I'd never been part of even a conversation about, you know, people who were gay. And because that was the world I came out of, right? There was just an absolute sort of silence around all of that. So when that kind of really came into my view in college, like, that was a huge shift for me. And really hearing someone who claimed to be a Christian talking about gay people as if they were subhuman, it just did not make sense to me. And it was when I realized my own internalized homophobia, and that was just sort of in the culture I grew up in, And it wasn't like I became, you know, like queer affirming, right? And back then, the word queer was not as commonplace as it is today. But then that became a way for me to then dig deeper into things like feminism, my own relationship to Christianity, and recognizing the ways that the versions of Christianity I had been raised in were very patriarchal, and that they were not a place where I could thrive. So that was the very, very beginning for me.
So it wasn't, like you said, just one major event, right? But it was a few. But then it also just opened your eyes to not just a different perspective, but different perspectives.
Exactly. Right. And I think that was the big thing, is recognizing there's not one singular truth. There's not one singular way mm-hmm. to view the world. And of course, and this is one of the reasons why I teach college today, is because I think that's such an exciting time in one's life, because students come to college knowing they are going to hear different perspectives. And it's the time where they figure out, okay, what do I believe? What are my commitments? So I feel that I've been able to sort of make my career working with students in that time of life is sort of one of the things that brings me great joy.
Awesome. Well, thanks for giving us the background there on your past and how you got to where you are here today. I think there are many people who followed the same path, and that's why I wanted to have you on here. We only have a little bit of time, so let's talk about the Christian nationalist movement, or the white Christian nationalist movement here. As I said here in my intro, I've been talking about this for a few years, and I have to admit, it was a phrase, Doctor, that I rarely heard or really used, and I'm not sure I ever used it until 2016 or 2017 with the Trump presidency. But the thing is, Christian nationalism has always been around. It's just now that it really feels like to many of us that it's gaining some real traction and power. And I think that's due in part to all these different sects of conservative Christianity that are coming together to form like a coalition, if you shall. And so maybe this is where I ask you to explain how you define Christian nationalism or white Christian nationalism, and how it is steeped into the white culture myth that's prevalent in our nation's history.
Yeah, I love that you use the word myth. My next book, the book I'm working on right now, is about dismantling myths of innocence as related to purity culture, white Christian nationalism, and these sort of myths we tell about the United States. And they're all sort of tied up in the notion of innocence. Yeah, so white Christian nationalism, as you said, right, it's a concept that's been around for a long time. What happened in 1617 was the sociologists Sam Perry and Andrew Whitehead published a book coining that term. And so now we have more exact tools for being able to identify, well, what are the beliefs, you know, who are the collectives, how are people organizing themselves, who are the leaders of these groups. But this is a topic that scholars have been studying forever, because it has been part of the United States forever. It's very much part of the debate of the question, you know, what is America? What is a democracy? But now we are able to see it with much more clarity. And of course, it's really important because it is showing up in so many different places and shaping public policy, especially around reproductive rights, trans rights. And there's some very aggressive rhetoric and tactics that are being used to conform U.S. political life to a very narrow understanding of Christian theology. And one of the things that white Christian nationalism does is it doesn't acknowledge that there is a diversity of Christianities just in the United States,
right?
That there are so many different Christian traditions. And yet we have this really unhealthy coupling, almost incestuous relationship between Protestant Christianity and the nation state, and one that people have seen as the nation has become more religiously diverse, more racially diverse, that there has been some anxiety invoked that the United States is no longer a Christian nation. The United States is no longer populated primarily by white people who identify as Christian. And so that is where then we see the backlash. Like, this is where we are right now, have been for several years, is in a moment of backlash against social progress. Carol Anderson is a historian at Emory University, wrote a book called White Rage. And in it, she traces how progress, especially for African Americans, has always gotten backlash. If we look at sort of the Trump era, the era of white Christian nationalism, right, that is backlash to the Obama administration and to the election of the first Black president. So white Christian nationalism is very much part of the DNA in the United States that we need to sort of uncover and think about. But it is right now, because we are in a cycle of backlash, it is being used as a pretty effective tool to scare other people into maintaining the status quo.
I was going to ask you about the nation's psychology, or maybe the socialization of whiteness, as to why we always see these inevitable white backlashes, like you said, to the first Black president or to the George Floyd protests. But I mean, you could go further and further back, Civil War, you could to Reconstruction, you could go to why, that's why we got the Jim Crow laws and the backlash to civil rights and all that, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And even further, you know, I teach about the history of race in the United States. And one of the things, and it was actually a student who said this in class, and now I always teach it, but if you look at the Virginia Slave Code, 1768, I want to say, I'm a historian who's terrible with dates, right? But we're talking the colonial period, when there were slaves of both African and European descent, and they were starting to work together because slaves outnumbered slave owners, and they were starting to fight back. And so the Virginia Slave Codes did a divide and conquer, where they gave different sets of rights to slaves of European descent and slaves of African descent, that created these categories of Blackness and whiteness. And so if we see that as a form of backlash, right, against people standing up for their humanity, that takes us so, so far back. And now I'm forgetting your original question.
No, I was just asking, like, is this just a psychology or a socialization of whiteness that has just always been prevalent with in this country?
Yeah. Well, and the thing about whiteness is its invisibility, right? The way that we don't speak about it, which is why I get nervous when people drop the white from Christian nationalism as if, like, oh, we don't have to talk about the race piece. It's like, yeah, we do. And so, you know, and this was part of my concern with the podcast, was how do you make whiteness visible? Because those of us who've been socialized into a white racial identity have been taught not to speak about race, that it's not polite to talk about race. And so we think that being colorblind is a virtue, which it's not. It's simply a way of ignoring the issue and therefore leaving the people who are most impacted by it, people of color, to have to deal with racism and white supremacy on their own. And nothing can change. As we know from the history of the civil rights movement, nothing can change until white people get involved. Mm-hmm. And so, at least in terms of numerically. And there was the summer of George Floyd. Everyone was reading about Robin DeAngelis and, you know, and other sort of anti-racist stuff. And I don't know if you've noticed, but that has gone away. The thing about being white is you can opt out of these very difficult discussions. So that's sort of thinking psychologically on the individual level. But if we look sociologically on sort of the national level, we are in a moment where there is a lot of anxiety about how we do history, how we tell history, what it is that children should be learning about our history. As you know, in my podcast, I include a clip from a woman informed by Moms for Liberty, who took her kids out of the school system because she didn't want them to learn about slavery and feel bad for being white, right? And so there's a kind of need for the preservation of innocence. And unfortunately, the way we do that is by creating false narratives about the United States, right? That, hey, things were bad in the past, but they're getting better. The civil rights movement solved all of our problems, and everything else is just interpersonal. And so now that there's such a prominent move against telling the truth historically, you know, that puts us easily into a place of being complacent and not challenging the dominant narratives about the nation state, especially about our innocence, about our worthiness. And to put it in the language of white Christian nationalists, you know, about the special relationship to God, and sort of all that is mixed up and creates kind of this nice, you know, I'm drawing on Marx here, who I was just talking about last week, you know, and a really nice opiate. If we have the opportunity to be comfortable and be assured, then we will take it. I see that happening a lot right now, as opposed to being willing to sit with the hard truths.
Oh, man, there's so much I have to ask you, and we just have so little time. Just two more quick questions, if you don't mind. Mm-hmm. This idea of purity, of goodness, you know, the purity mm-hmm. culture, mm-hmm. which is a major trope within this movement. I'd say it's like it's shifting to inside other Christian traditions, but also mm-hmm. maybe even some non-religious people. Mm-hmm. Like if you're mm-hmm. online and you're reading some of these influencers yep. on the right, okay, it seems like it's filtered yeah. over to them too. And yeah. but still, this purity culture that you study, it helps explain so much, especially when it comes to race and gender in this country, and why believers of this mm-hmm. movement believe that it's key to have control or dominion mm-hmm. over a woman's agency over her body mm-hmm. and medical decisions, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, because it really is about, you know, this belief that God designed things in a particular way. And that there is a singular design for a nation, for a family, and that obedience is everything. You know, I was just chuckling the other day, sociologically, theologically, this stuff is lacks so much complexity, which is really disappointing for just someone who wants. But whenever I really get to the bottom of this, it's like they just want dominance, right? They mm-hmm. want domination. They want dominion. Is the word that you see a lot. And absolutely. And so, and in that right there's the hierarchy about who has power. And it's, you know, white men who have power and they are sort of closest to God. So, you know, but a very clear kind of social order that is designed by God. And to me, as a historian, when I look at that, what I see is in terms of US history of politics, I see the Confederacy. Right. Because the Confederacy was very much a biblical patriarchal society in which the hierarchy had to very much be reinforced. And white women in these situations, like that's where I'm really interested in. And what my book is going to be about is the ways that white womanhood is used to promote that, even though white women don't fully benefit from it, but there are ways that they can participate and gain great advantages from it. And of course, there are informal ways that these come into our cultural norms. But the Confederacy was very, I think, the most blatant explanation about that. I mean, one thing that I think people need to understand is that arguments for slavery use the same texts that were against gender equality. And not that those experiences are the same, but the arguments in support of the hierarchy of the white supremacist patriarchy draw on the exact same biblical teachings. And we see that very clearly in the 19th century.
Yeah, something that everybody has to remember for sure. Hey, Dr. Mm-hmm. Sarah Mosliner, thank you so much for being on. Lecturer, writer, and researcher in the Department of Philosophy and Anthropology and Religion at Central Michigan University. She wrote the book titled Virgin Nation, Sexual Purity and American Adolescence, and has an 8-part podcast series called Pure White. Dr. Mosliner, I will make sure to provide links to your podcast and your website. And I assume also if people want to get your book, if they visit sarahmosliner.com, that's the best place that they can get a copy?
Yes.
Outstanding. Well, listen, yeah. Thank you so much for being on this week. I only scratched the surface here, so I would love to have you back again sometime in the near future if that would be okay with you.
Absolutely. That would be great. Thank you.
It's progressivism with passion. It's the Left of Lansing podcast, where Pat shines a light on Michigan's progressive movement. Contact Pat at leftoflansing@gmail.com.
You know, there was a part near the end of our talk there where Dr. Mosliner compared the white Christian nationalist movement to the Confederacy. And you know what? She's not wrong. She's not. Think about it. When it comes to the removal of Confederate statues or names of Confederates from military bases, who's fighting to get rid of them and who's fighting to keep them? Who? Special thanks to Dr. Sarah Mosliner for offering her insights and expertise on the issue of white Christian nationalism, which leads to my new weekly poll, which you can find on Twitter at Left of Lansing. The question is, does the possibility of white Christian nationalism gaining more power if Donald Trump wins scare you more now than ever before? Your answers are yes, no, I'm not sure. Time now for a Left of Lansing last call.
That's it. Cut it, and you're going to cut this, and you're going to clip this so that it's completely out of context. I already said that it was, and y'all are just going to pretend that it wasn't over and over again. It's fucked up, man. And you're not helping these
live
people,
TV.
And you're not helping them.
You refuse to.
You're not helping them.
Well, that was Democratic New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez dealing with protesters who are against Israel's bombardment and violence in Gaza. And listen, I devoted some extra time in this segment last week explaining my uncommitted vote in the primary, and I'd do it again if the primary were this week. I am 100% against what the right-wing Israeli government is doing, and I disagree with any American politician, including President Biden, who just keeps letting Israel kill innocent men, women, and children in that open-air prison over there. And I will continue to speak out against it, and I will always support those who speak out against atrocities and who speak out against injustice. But there are some in the uncommitted movement, or simply those against what's happening in Gaza, who are, in my opinion, hurting their own cause. Look, I get protesting Biden administration officials or Democratic Party leadership on this issue, but I don't understand going after AOC, who's always been a staunch critic of the Netanyahu regime's corruptness and its treatment of the Palestinian people. Right now, she's a member of the minority in Congress who doesn't really wield a whole lot of power right now in Washington. Attacking an ally like that makes me wonder if everyone in this movement is really progressive. And in my humble opinion, if this movement is true to its belief that it's against current U.S. policy over there, then it had better hold both parties' feet to the fire. However, I'm not seeing many pro-Palestinian protesters at Trump rallies, considering he wouldn't do anything different, nor would he even try to quell the violence over there. And that's why I fear that maybe some are hijacking this movement to attack just progressives and progressives only. Listen, if you care about the Palestinian people and think we could be doing more, then protest Joe Biden all you want. But if you're not protesting Trump and you're not protesting his white Christian nationalist allies who are 100% pro-Israel, then I'm afraid you've lost the plot.
You're listening to the Left of Lansing podcast. The music you're hearing is by Wander Beats. To hear the latest project, check out Space Leopard on your favorite streaming site. Now back to our favorite progressive voice in Michigan. It's Pat Johnston.
That's going to do it for this edition of The Left of Lansing. Remember, I'll leave links to Dr. Sarah Mosliner's podcast called Pure White on Left of Lansing, and you can visit her website for more info. That's sarahmosliner.com. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast and give this podcast a 5-star rating if you don't mind. I'll accept a 4-star rating too. That's fine. But remember, this podcast is devoted to highlighting the progressive movement that's happening in the state of Michigan, and this podcast is devoted to helping spread the progressive, or as I say, the common sense message to keep Michigan moving forward. We've made some significant strides, and we can't allow the radical white Christian nationalism of the Republican Party to grab control of the state house this fall. We can't, not to mention the White House and Congress. Let us control the message. Let us push the narrative for a change. Put the other side on the defensive because, I'm going to say this again, they have no popular policy positions. No one wants what they're offering, which is why I say take the battle to them. Thank you, Michigan.
The Left of Lansing podcast was produced by Pat Johnston, written by Pat Johnston, researched by Pat Johnston, edited by Pat Johnston, and hosted by, yes, Pat Johnston. Technical assistance by Dr. Heather. And thanks to our good friend Kirsten for the awesome podcast logo. Remember to visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information. Thanks again for listening to the Left of Lansing podcast.